This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, one of the world's top China analysts takes us inside the mind of Xi Jinping. What is the Chinese president going to do about the protests in Hong Kong?
They're dialing up the rhetoric to justify possible intervention. I mean, they don't want to do it, but in the end, they might have to do it.
And the breakthrough solar technology that Australian scientists say should have been developed here. But first, the stabbing death of a young woman in Sydney's CBD has highlighted the risks faced by sex workers. There were terrifying scenes yesterday as a man ran through the streets armed with a large knife. He was eventually overpowered by local workers, but the body of a 24-year-old woman who was a sex worker was found in an apartment complex near where the alleged attacker was apprehended. Isabel Rowe has our report.
On Sydney's Clarence Street, people were going about their usual business, walking to their offices, grabbing a coffee as they go. But today, work wasn't the only thing on their minds.
A little bit of apprehension. It's a bit unsafe, I guess, in that way. We've got to get on with things, so...
Aside from a few parked police cars, nothing of note remains at the scene of yesterday's attack. The suspect, 21-year-old Mert Ney, is in hospital. New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Fuller.
We will allege that he's killed a 24-year-old woman for no reason, and he stabbed another woman in her 40s and potentially threatened to kill a number of other people at the same time.
Police allegedly found the man in possession of a USB with information about massacres in other countries. They also say he had recently admitted himself to hospital and was given some form of mental health treatment. Commissioner Fuller says his criminal history is unremarkable, although he was wanted over domestic violence offences and had been reported missing by his family.
He was on the system as keep a lookout for him for both of those things as a missing person. So from our perspective, again, that is not unusual in terms of what we see day in and day out in some houses across New South Wales.
Phone records show the suspect called a 24-year-old woman for sex work services before stabbing her at an apartment in Clarence Street. Police haven't been able to contact her family yet, but say she is an Australian citizen. The woman's death sends shivers down the spines of many women in the escort industry, according to Melbourne-based sex worker Rose Harper.
I think it does kind of shatter our sense of safety quite a bit. Obviously, with escorting, you're often working alone, especially, I don't know the circumstances of what happened yesterday, but I mean, I work from a Sydney in call by myself regularly. There's certain safety measures that I take for sure, but at the end of the day, you know, I'm a 5'5" woman. I could probably be overpowered by almost any man out there.
Sex work is legal in New South Wales, but in Victoria, Rose Harper says women aren't always able to go to the police if they feel unsafe.
This sort of occurrence maybe isn't preventable, but a lot of violence against sex workers is definitely preventable, or at least more things can be done to minimise the risks. And that's generally with the laws that enable us to like have easier time reporting things to police and that kind of thing.
In the hours after the attack, authorities were quick to label those who subdued the suspect as heroes. And this morning, Police Minister David Elliott told media that yesterday was Sydney at its best. Rose Harper also wants the female victim to be remembered with respect and honour.
I have noticed in a few articles that I've read that it's kind of been tacked on like a footnote almost that, oh yeah, and by the way, a 21-year-old woman or a 21-year-old sex worker, they don't even necessarily always use the word woman. They just use her job title, sex worker was murdered, just tacked on at the bottom of the article, which is quite abrupt. And it is upsetting because it does kind of remind the whole sex worker community that that might be all we're known as someday. If something unfortunate does happen to us, we're not, you know, I wouldn't be Rose. I would just be, oh, that sex worker.
Rose Harper speaking there to our reporter Isabel Rowe. Heading overseas now, flights have resumed at Hong Kong Airport this morning as protesters caused a second day of disruptions at one of Asia's busiest transport hubs. The airport has now obtained an interim injunction to ban the protests, but with demonstrations now entering their third month, China is massing troops on the border and stepping up state media rhetoric about the protesters. So what is Beijing's next move? One person watching that closely is the Lowy Institute's China analyst Richard McGregor. He's an expert on China's political system, and his latest book is on Chinese President Xi Jinping. Richard McGregor, welcome back to The World Today.
Thank you.
Now, you've researched China's leader very closely. Take us inside the mind of Xi Jinping as he watches these protesters in Hong Kong just keep coming back onto the streets and into the airport. What is he thinking?
It's a very good question and a very difficult one to answer. And it's the key question, really, which is, will China have an armed intervention in Hong Kong? And there are many things which would be driving them to do that, and a lot of things which would be sort of pushing them in the other direction. You know, the Hong Kong government has lost control. The protesters aren't stepping back. And there are many people in Beijing who are arguing, well, we're going to have to intervene, the sooner the better. The flip side of that, of course, is that intervention will be a disaster. It's just a matter about how much of a disaster it will be. You know, this will be something that China can't control. Hong Kong has a vigorous Chinese and English language media, let alone tens of thousands of citizen journalists with their mobile phones. It's not something you can just lock down like a suburb in a city in China. In other words, there might be armed intervention, but the protests will go on for a long, long time. The second thing, of course, is, leaving aside international outcry, there's the issue of Taiwan, which is a much bigger prize for China. They have an election next January, which China is trying to influence. Intervention in Hong Kong will be bad for them in Taiwan.
A lot of people we've spoken to in Hong Kong dismiss the notion that Xi would order in troops to quell this, saying that he couldn't possibly risk another Tiananmen. Your view?
That's right up to a point. First of all, I don't think it would be troops, because the Chinese leadership learned their lesson in 89. The use of the military was a disaster. They've since built up a sort of anti-right paramilitary, if you like, called the People's Armed Police. Now, that may be a distinction without a difference, you know, whether it's the PLA or the People's Armed Police, but still it's unlikely to be the military. But the point of view from the other Chinese point of view is that this just can't go on like it is. It's too much of a loss of face for the leadership. They've been pushed too far. I'm not agreeing with this view, by the way. I'm just looking at it from their point of view. Hong Kong is part of China and they have lost control of it, and they have to get it under control. Now, there's no good options. That's the truth of it. And the Hong Kong government has been no other option except to send in their own riot police with great violence, which, of course, is just leading to further protests. So it's a really, really difficult situation.
What are his options, Xi's options, if these protests continue?
Well, they've already made it clear they're ready for intervention. State media in China has shown the People's Armed Police on the border in Shenzhen. Now, of course, they're having that public display of force in the hope that they won't have to go in, but they're ready. Secondly, they've begun to prepare public opinion in China for some kind of intervention. Initially, the state media in China just talked about the protesters as protesters. Then they were called mobs. Then they were called criminal thugs. This week they've been called terrorists. So they're dialing up the rhetoric to justify possible intervention. I mean, they don't want to do it, but in the end, they might have to do it.
And do you think they will?
You know, you're putting me on the spot there. You know, I think it was once unthinkable, but it's moving in that direction, actually. I'm not there yet, but we're heading down that path.
And that's the Lowy Institute's China analyst, Richard McGregor. The Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police have stridently defended the AFP raids on media organisations at an inquiry in Canberra today. The Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security is investigating the impact of police and intelligence powers on the freedom of journalists to report the news. Yesterday, the heads of Australia's major media organisations told the committee that the laws were silencing legitimate journalism. Julia Holman is covering the inquiry for The World Today.
The long arm of the law reaches into a Canberra journalist's home.
We had that news just in of another raid today of ABC's offices in Sydney.
Australian police have raided the country's public broadcaster.
When a News Corp journalist's Canberra home and then the ABC's headquarters in Sydney were raided 2 days in a row, questions were asked around the world about whether Australia's media was under attack.
I now welcome members of the Australian Federal Police to give evidence for the Hansard record.
Today in Canberra, the police agency which conducted the raids, the Australian Federal Police, defended its methods in front of the Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security.
As police, we do not target specific sectors of the community, such as the media. We target criminality.
The Commissioner of the AFP is Andrew Colvin.
I want to reassure this committee and anyone listening that we do understand the magnitude and the nature of any interaction between police and a journalist. Contrary to the perception, this is not a decision that we take lightly. In fact, in the last 5 years alone, the AFP has received 75 referrals for potential unauthorised disclosure offences. Each and every one of them could have resulted in evidence being sought from a journalist or a media organisation. However, there have only been two occasions in that time where an investigation has led to that action taking place.
Yesterday, media chiefs from the ABC, News Corp and Nine told the committee hearing in Sydney that there was a culture of secrecy in Australia and national security laws were having a chilling effect on journalism. Liberal Senator Erica Betts asked the AFP Commissioner about those claims.
Do you accept and understand that by the very nature of having somebody knock on your door or whatever, identifying themselves as an AFP officer, that it is somewhat of a confronting circumstance?
Senator, what I would say is most people live their life happy if they never have to interact with police. If they do, I'm sure it's not a pleasant experience at times.
It's still not clear what action, if any, will be taken against the journalists whose work was the subject of the AFP probes. The Deputy AFP Commissioner, Neil Gagan, refused to answer if News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst is still under investigation.
We still have some work to do in relation to the person who we suspect has provided the information to Ms. Smethurst. So I've just got to be really careful where I go with answering these questions.
Sure.
That is a live investigation.
Labor's Mark Dreyfus unsuccessfully tried to get the AFP Commissioner to clarify his deputy's answer.
As we sit here, it remains the case that Annika Smethurst could be charged.
It remains the case that the investigation is ongoing.
There were questions asked about why the raids happened more than a year after the stories were published. Commissioner Colvin said there was nothing sinister in the timing, nor were the actions a result of political interference.
The AFP is accused of being politicised in this regard a lot. There is a very big distinction between being accused of being politicised and acting politically. We do not act politically. There is no direction to us on these matters. We make these judgments on our own experience and our own operational knowledge, and we act independently.
Later today, security and intelligence agencies, including ASIO, will give evidence to the inquiry. The committee's report is due to be handed down on the 17th of October.
Julia Holman reporting. This is The World Today. And if you miss a program or you're just joining us now, you can find all our stories on the ABC Listen app. Or you can subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And you can follow me at Eleanor Hall 1. The Prime Minister is en route to Tuvalu this lunchtime to meet other political leaders at the Pacific Islands Forum. But he's in for a rough reception. The Prime Minister of Tuvalu has warned Scott Morrison that the island nations will not be bought off with the $500 million in climate funding that Mr. Morrison announced earlier in the week. They're calling on Australia to bring down its greenhouse gas emissions and not to open any new coal mines. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
This year's Pacific Islands Forum is being held on the front line of climate change, the island nation of Tuvalu. Its Prime Minister, Anele Sopoaga, worries that without urgent action, Tuvalu will eventually disappear beneath the waves.
We are already heading towards a 3 degrees Celsius temperature increase by the end of the century. That would spell complete demise and submersion of Tuvalu and islands like Tuvalu into the sea. This is ridiculous, and I don't think it is acceptable. It's totally unacceptable for Tuvalu.
The country is already dealing with erosion along its coastline, diminished food crops and storms. In light of that, Tuvalu and other island nations are very clear about what they want from this week's leaders' meeting. They're demanding Australia stop building coal mines and dramatically cut its greenhouse gas emissions. Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Alex Hawke, told RN Breakfast he's listening to their concerns.
When you come here, you can't help but listen because it's a very small place threatened by climate change and you see it graphically on the ground. We're listening. Australia's lifted its commitment just this week to increase our spending.
He's referring to yesterday's announcement of $500 million redirected from the existing aid budget to help Pacific nations deal with the effects of climate change. It's part of Australia's step-up efforts in the Pacific to counter the growing influence of China. But Alex Hawke says Australia's already doing a good job of reducing emissions, and he's made clear it won't be signing up to a communique that includes the immediate phasing out of coal.
We wouldn't want to see talks break down, but every country has their position, every country has the things that they need to stick with. Australia has a position that we need to stick with. And
is it a red line? Is it a red line issue for Australia? You won't sign up to a communique that says this.
It certainly is a red line issue. It certainly is a red line issue. There's a great deal of respect between leaders when they get here today and all sit together. There's a great deal of listening. We listen to Pacific Island countries about what they need and we assist. But they also listen to us about the way our economy is structured, the plans we have in place. The respect between leaders today will be high. But yes, of course, Australia has a red line position on coal.
Tuvalu's Prime Minister Anele Sopoaga says that's not good enough.
Well, let me say that we are already crossing the red lines for Tuvalu in terms of survival. We are already crossing the red lines to keep, to save the small island countries and also to keep them afloat above water.
And he's disparaged Australia's latest offer of aid to deal with the impacts of climate change, saying it doesn't get Australia out of its responsibility to minimise damage to the environment.
Whether it's 500 million or 1 billion or whatever, it doesn't make any difference from the obligations as leaders, as countries to reduce greenhouse gases. I think it's almost like, buying off the support. Tuvalu is not, I'm not going to say to do that in the sake of saving my people.
That's likely to lead to some tense discussions once Scott Morrison arrives in Tuvalu this afternoon.
Alexandra Beach reporting. Well, a business leader dubbed the Sun King for his role developing the global solar industry says Australia should be a clean energy superpower. Dr. Zhenrong Shi, who was trained in Australia, was in Sydney this morning for the release of a new development in solar panel technology. He says it's disappointing that the solar technology that made him his first billion wasn't able to be developed here. Gavin Coote has our report.
It's a typically sunny morning in Sydney's Darling Harbour, and many see this as a fitting place for the country's largest lightweight solar panel system. 812 panels now cover the rooftop of Wharf 7 at Australia's National Maritime Museum. Each panel weighs about 5.5 kilos, about a quarter of the weight of conventional panels. Its inventor is Dr. Zhenyong Ji, once dubbed the Sun King after becoming the world's first solar billionaire more than a decade ago.
There are a lot of buildings, especially commercial and industry rooftops, which were built like 20 plus years ago. And some are the heritage buildings. They cannot handle the weight of glass-based conventional solar panels. So according to statistics, 40% of roofs, cannot handle this weight. And with that knowledge, me and our team have been thinking, well, in that case, we have to develop something light, right? But still reliable, high efficiency and robust and also affordable.
You've actually got one here on display, one of these panels.
Yeah.
It can be picked up with practically one arm, can't it?
Exactly, yes. Very light.
The installation of these lightweight panels is expected to cut the Australian National Maritime Museum's energy bills by a quarter. Its CEO, Kevin Sumption, says they don't plan to stop at the historic Wharf 7 building.
The main museum building here is a heritage building with very particular aesthetics. It's a beautiful white building. Black or blue panels don't really work, and he's already looking into ways and means of creating a white solar panel for us. Tiny bit less energy efficient, but again, an incredible way to use solar panels, in this case, as part of the fabric of the building, which I think is the exciting future for solar panel technology.
Dr. Zhenrong Ji is a man of great ambition. Born in a poor rural area of China, he excelled in solar research after moving to Australia and studying at the University of New South Wales. After forging his way into the commercial world, he became a billionaire but then lost his fortune in the 2000s. Dr. Ji's lightweight panels were developed in Asia and says it's a shame they couldn't be made here where he trained.
I think there are a lot of regulations here, right? And you can't move things very fast, and also sometimes the slow means expensive. So I think for this type of innovation, you really need to do quickly and introduce the innovation into the market as quickly as possible, because we are facing a serious problem of climate change. You know, we need to make innovation quickly and practical and introduce into the market quickly.
Are there ways that could be streamlined and attract this type of manufacturing here in Australia?
Yeah, they could, especially like if we can import materials and do this final product integration here in Australia. I think that's feasible.
Some of the financial support for the lightweight solar panel came from the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. But its CEO, Darren Miller, says it's not entirely realistic to manufacture this type of technology locally.
Well, it's hard to say from a manufacturing point of view because there's such low margins in manufacturing solar panels. What we have in Australia is fabulous expertise throughout the universities here in terms of fundamental research and development of solar technologies, and we should continue to pursue that in Australia. Ultimately, manufacturing will happen throughout the world where it's cheapest, and we'll benefit from that ultimately. As you can see, it comes back to Australia's shores. So it is a big circle of innovation, and Australia is right at the early stages and benefits at the late stages.
But irrespective of where the technology is developed, Dr. G says there's a big opportunity for Australia to lead the green tech revolution.
Gavin Coot with that report. Approximately 1 in 10 young Australians harm themselves. They usually do it in secret and go to great lengths to cover it up. Now a new guide has been released aiming to give parents practical tips on how to identify self-harm and how to give their child the help they need. Bridget Fitzgerald has our story.
Firstly, it was behaviours that I had seen that were out of character.
Jen, not her real name, noticed several changes in her son before she discovered he was self-harming.
Hiding in his room, extra time in the bathroom, started wearing longer shirts, longer pairs of shorts. He would usually, you know, wear football shorts. Then he was wearing shorts down to almost his knees.
Covering arms and legs is often one of the first signs of self-harm, a practice that experts say is on the rise. The Australian Institute of Family Studies found 10% of 14 and 15-year-olds have self-harmed in the past year.
Unfortunately, we know that self-harm is common amongst young Australians.
Associate Professor Jo Robinson is the head of suicide prevention research at Origin, the National Centre for Excellence in Youth Mental Health. It's developed a guide called Coping with Self-Harm, which aims to help families identify and deal with the behaviour.
Parents are often one of the first ports of call for young people, so it's really important, I guess, that they're able to recognise when their young person might be distressed or engaging in a behaviour like self-harm, and also feel kind of equipped and prepared to know how to respond and provide them with the sort of support that they might need.
Self-harm is when someone does something to deliberately hurt themselves. Early indicators can be easy to miss. There might be a sudden shift in mood, changes to eating or sleeping habits, or unexplained injuries. Jo Robinson says if parents notice something is wrong, they need to ask.
We worry that asking about suicide or self-harm will put ideas in a young person's head, but actually the evidence increasingly tells us that that's not the case.
The guide being launched today offers practical advice.
Try not to panic, try not to freak out. Let the young person know that you're there for them and that you love them. Self-harm can be terribly confronting, but remember that behind that behaviour is a distressed young person who needs some support.
Mary Jane Bell began to self-harm at 8 years old and continued into her 20s.
But I always made sure I did it where no one could see the scars. Self-harmers are very sneaky.
Now in her late 60s, Mary Jane Bell says her parents didn't know what to do, and it wasn't until she was married that she was able to stop with the support of her husband. Her advice to parents today is to be open and compassionate.
All you can do is just give them all the love you can, give them understanding, sit down and talk to them about it.
Nick Digan agrees. He's a senior clinical advisor with the Youth Mental Health Foundation, Headspace.
Strong attachments with parents are incredibly important, and they can help to speed up a recovery from difficult times and help to also reduce the intensity and severity of any set of difficulties.
When Jen's son was struggling, she felt she didn't have the resources to help. She hopes this guide will shed some light on an important issue.
When you don't know where to turn or what to do or what to say, it's terrifying. So to have a resource like that is something that I would be putting out to anyone that came to me.
That's advice from one parent, Jen, speaking there to Bridget Fitzgerald. And if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 1114 or the Kids Helpline on 1800 55 1800. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ruby Jones, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Right now, millions of Muslims are making the annual pilgrimage to Mecca.
It's called the Hajj, and it's a journey that all Muslims are expected to make at least once in their life.
But Mecca is in Saudi Arabia, and a number of Muslims say they'll boycott it because of the Saudi government's actions in Yemen.
Today on The Signal, what do you do when your religious duties clash with your morals?
Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.